From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, sex surveys. They reveal what we're doing in our bedrooms, or at least what we say we're doing in our bedrooms. And sometimes the surveys reveal as much about the researchers as they do about us. Sociologist Julia Erickson will tell us about the evolution of sex surveys over the past century. Also, Music for Torching, a new novel about the complicated terrain of marriage. We talk with the author, A.M. Holmes. And Ed Ward reviews On Broadway, a new collection of rare pop treasures that came out of New York's Brill Building in the late 50s and early 60s. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton is trying to get help to farmers hurt by the prolonged hot spell. In some parts of the country, farmers are facing the worst drought since the Great Depression. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton today declared all of West Virginia and a number of counties in adjoining states disaster areas. That means farmers there will be able to get low-interest emergency loans.
We're also working with local governments and private agencies to help farmers get water and hay to keep their livestock alive. It's literally a problem for them to keep their livelihoods alive.
President Clinton says he will also work with Congress to fix some of the problems with the Freedom to Farm Act. That act reformed the national system of agriculture subsidies, but it also made it harder for farmers and ranchers to deal with natural disasters like the drought. Press Secretary Joe Lockhart says the president wants structural fixes in the bill to come first before he decides whether or not to support a $10 billion emergency appropriation to help farmers. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
A federal judge in Washington ruled today that the Christian Coalition may pass out voter guides in churches before elections. The ruling came in a suit filed against the Christian group by the Federal Election Commission, which accused the coalition of giving illegal help to Republican candidates. The FEC specifically complained about the Christian Coalition's contact with election campaigns and the recommendations that churchgoers vote for certain candidates. U.S. District Judge Joyce Green said those activities didn't amount to excessive campaign contributions. Yugoslav farmers blocked two main roads north of Belgrade today in a protest over low government prices for grain. NPR's Sarah Chase reports.
Several hundred farmers and their red tractors, like the ones Kosovo Albanian and now Serb refugees have fled in, blocked the road leading northeast of Belgrade across the grain-producing flatlands of northern Serbia. The farmers are protesting the low price the government pays for their wheat, just a few pennies a pound, when they even get the payment. Like teachers and retirees, farmers have been receiving money the government owes them months late, but they can't sell their surplus on the free market. Surplus agricultural products have typically been a source of cash for the Yugoslav government, which trades them internationally for oil or luxury goods. Some farmers were briefly arrested, then the blockade was moved away by the police. Demonstrators said all their colleagues agree with them, but most are afraid to protest. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Belgrade.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 9 points to close at 10,646. Declines led advances by 4-3 in light trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 623 million shares. The average share lost 5 cents. This is National Public Radio News from Washington. NASA engineers say the space agency's newly released X-ray telescope satellite is not in its proper orbit. The $1.5 billion Chandra telescope is more than 500 miles lower than it should be, but astronomers say it can still perform its mission of looking into deep space for black holes. NASA engineers plan to fire the satellite's backup engines on Wednesday and Saturday in an effort to set the telescope at a better angle. The latest trial in the 45-year-old Sam Shepard murder case is taking shape in Cleveland. Kevin Niedermeyer reports from member station WKSU in Kent, Ohio.
A Cleveland judge has decided that when the Shepard murder case is reopened in October, a jury should hear the evidence. Shepard's family attorney, Terry Gilbert, had asked for a bench trial, saying it would be impossible to find impartial jurors, but now says he will prepare for a jury trial.
Well, I mean, this is one case that many people have opinions on. It's been part of the Cleveland legacy, and so it'll take some extensive questioning of the jury. So this may prolong the trial, but I think that we'll be able to get a fair jury.
The late Dr. Shepherd was convicted of killing his wife in 1954 and spent 10 years in prison before a retrial found him not guilty. Shepherd's son wants his father declared innocent so he has a chance to collect a wrongful imprisonment settlement. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Niedermeyer in Cleveland.
The Treasury Department said today that it expects to keep paying down the national debt during the third quarter. The department predicted that tax revenues provided by the booming economy will enable it to pay about $11 billion of the national debt between July and the end of September. Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. Let's face it, everyone is curious about the results of sex surveys. They shed a little light on the private behavior everyone engages in, but few admit in public. Sex surveys have been the staple of so-called men's and women's magazines and have made Kinsey and Masters and Johnson household names. My guest, Julia Erickson, is the co-author of a new book, Kiss and Tell, which reviews 100 years of sex surveys from the late 19th century to today. She found that the questions, even more than the answers, have had a lasting influence on what sexual behavior is considered appropriate and what is seen as deviant. Erickson is a professor of sociology at Temple University. A caution to parents before we start our conversation. Some of this material may not be suitable for younger listeners. I asked Julia Erickson about the early surveys and the language that the Victorian researchers used in their work.
Well, the first published survey, which was undertaken in 1898, and was a survey of young men. There was a lot of concern at the time that young men would develop an interest in, a precocious interest in sexuality, and if they did it too early, they wouldn't really develop into the kind of fine, upstanding, middle-class young men that the nation needed. This was only a survey of the middle class. And there were three questions that were asked on that survey, and one was, what is your severest temptation? And
the second one... That's a direct quote, right?
Yes. The second one was, did you yield? And the third one was, how often?
Huh.
And, of course, today... I don't know that people would say sex necessarily. If you said, what is your severest temptation? They might say chocolate or ice cream or something to do with food or, you know, something else. Or alcohol, perhaps, or smoking. But at the time, almost all of these young men knew the question meant sex. And they either, most of them said masturbation. And a significant minority of them said prostitution.
That they saw that as
severest
as
temptation.
Severest,
yes.
Temptation.
Yes.
So even though the word sex was never used,
yes,
it was the language of the time. Middle class men knew,
understood what,
was being
what it
about.
Meant. Yes.
What do you think, though, in asking the questions the way they did, the researchers were trying to do and say? And your book really is about how the questions really, mm-hmm, have an influence and shape our, mm-hmm, view of sexuality, mm-hmm, and men and women and men and men, mm-hmm, and women and women. What were the cautionary words or the cautionary point of view that was coming out of those questions?
That young men had a precocious interest in sexuality, even very good young men. And in fact, in that particular survey, a group of the young men were training for the ministry, and they too were tempted by masturbation, and most of them had yielded. And the author, the survey was actually done by a worker for the YMCA, and they were quite horrified, but they clearly expected to find those results, and there were a whole series of surveys done over the next 15 or 20 years showing that the nation really was in trouble because boys were learning from other boys too early about sex, developing an interest in sex too early, not developing healthy same-sex play interests. And this was going to be bad for the nation's future.
So it was about trying to control then these,
yes,
sexual urges.
Yes, yes. And in fact, some of the researchers even said before they undertook the research that they knew what they expected to find. And what they were trying to promote was sex education in the schools, and a sex education of the sort that would tell you what not to do, you know, what we might, didn't use the word then, but what we might call abstinence education.
Right.
They thought if young men learned about sex from the proper source, then they wouldn't misbehave. They would know that this was too precious an activity. But if they were learning about it on the street, they were learning of these bad activities.
And the proper source was what, school, religious leaders?
Religious, family ideally, but families weren't educated to do it. If you could raise a generation, that was the theory behind sex education, if you could raise a generation of Americans in the schools to know how to talk about sex and its dangers in a serious way, then that generation would be able to raise their children properly. We're still waiting for that to happen, I might say, but...
And you talk about, I guess, the sublimation of these sexual energies into sports, what?
Into play, into other activities, into sports. So this was a very significant part of the reason for the founding of the YMCA was to give boys healthy activities and take their minds away from precocious activities. But particularly, there was a lot of concern about cities. The idea was that on farms, boys had worked and they'd been stayed as children for a much longer period of time. They hadn't had these interests. But the cities were full of vice and sin, and you could get away from your parents. Your parents didn't know what you were doing. And that's really the rationale for founding the YMCA.
Well, getting us into the 1920s, and you see a kind of a shift there that the emphasis being on sex as a pleasurable relationship between husbands and wives, mm-hmm. and the idea that it wasn't just a woman's duty, I guess, to perform sex with her husband, but there actually could be some kind of fulfilling relationship mm-hmm. between a husband and wife in a family. How did some of those surveys reflect some of those changes?
By the 1920s in the United States, there was a tremendous concern about rising divorce. This is the most divorcing society probably in the world, and divorces started occurring here much earlier than elsewhere. And many social critics in the 1920s were very concerned about divorce. And so one of the things that they were, particularly among the middle class, again, I mean, it's really important to emphasize that until probably the 1970s, there's very little concern about anybody other than the middle class.
Isn't that interesting?
In these surveys. And but this concern about divorce was that there was a lot of, you know, a lot of these people are eugenicists, so they believe that the middle class have better genes and they're going to produce better children. There's a lot of concern that women aren't marrying because they're going to college, and maybe even becoming lesbians if they go to single sex colleges. And so all of these concerns about divorce, about women going away to school, not needing men, becoming financially independent, led to this, I think, pitch more or less to educated women that their true destiny lay in marriage, and that a satisfying sex life would be one very important part of this happy marriage. There's a kind of discovery of this female sex drive during this period, and a focusing it towards what's seen as a kind of safe outlet within marriage. Men and women are going to stay together. The divorce is going to decline because they're going to have good sex in marriage. So you get a whole series of surveys to see what the state of marital sex is like.
But I wonder for women trying to answer these surveys, mm-hmm. Going from this sort of Victorian mm-hmm. time to the early 20s, mm-hmm. You know, people don't change overnight, mm-hmm. whether they felt that they were kind of up to the task, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's actually quite a bit of controversy about the state of sex in the Victorian marriage, and that's just a little bit of another topic. So I'm not sure that I want to make the assumption that Victorian marriage was always totally sexually repressive, although it probably was more. There was a little more repression than there is today. But I think during this period, these women were very concerned to make them. These were married women, and they were or engaged. Some of them, at times, they interviewed engaged couples. They were very concerned to make their marriages work. They were mostly college students. By this time, there were dozens of courses on marriage and the family in American universities. It's the single biggest growth course in sociology departments in the country. And I think perhaps the reason that sociology grew so rapidly in America has to do with these courses. And so they sort of solved the problem of what to do about girls going to college was to teach them how to have better marriages. And so many of these surveys who were being done of these college students or college graduates who had taken these kinds of courses and who knew that they were supposed to be good at sex, but who also worried that they were too sexually repressed, and that this had learned from the research that this was going to be a difficult task and they weren't necessarily going to find it very easy. So I actually think more than a kind of Victorian carryover, what the surveys themselves are telling these women about, your marriage will depend on a good sex life, but a good sex life is going to be hard for you.
A very mixed message.
Yes.
I wonder, too, if there was concern in the 1920s about the the negative impact of divorce and the idea of focusing on family and sex being part of a relationship between a husband and wife. Were the researchers successful? Were they able to reduce the divorce rate?
No.
No, okay.
Divorces continued
very
to go
up. Very humbling to be a researcher.
Throughout this whole period, yes. But they continued to teach it for a very, very long time. They continued to teach these courses on marriage and to do their research and to try to figure out, you know, what constituted a good marital relationship and what constituted a good sexual relationship. And there was a little debate about whether the poor state of women's sexual response within marriage was due to the repression of girls and the poor upbringing of girls and the way girls were being taught to be sex repressed, or was it because the husbands were incompetent lovers? Because nobody ever had any doubt that men were in charge of the sexual relationship and that they initiated and women responded. The writers were quite explicit about that, actually.
And sort of promoting this idea that a woman's sexuality is just much more submissive or more passive, imaginative.
Yes, and that it's women are aroused by pursuit.
More about a century of sex surveys after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is sociologist Julia Erickson, author of the book Kiss and Tell, about sex surveys done over the last 100 years. Well, Kinsey's a name I think that most people know. How would you say that he revolutionized sex surveys, if he did at all?
Yes, I think he did. And I think probably the most important thing about Kinsey was that after Kinsey, sex surveys became something that the media got interested in and wrote about. And before Kinsey, the only writings in the media about sex, so usually were in the 1930s, there were some articles about the dangers to children of pedophiles. There was a lot of concern about pedophilia, and there were a lot of that, very much in the same way we've had panics recently about pedophilia in the 1930s, but there'd been very little else written about sex. And Kinsey published these two volumes that got enormous press. And it may interest you to know, for example, that when Kinsey wrote his first volume, but it was published in 1948, the volume on American Men, the New York Times refused to accept advertising for the book because it didn't think it was respectable in the Times. And that just shows, you know, a tremendous difference in the way the media would respond today.
And he was a biologist,
he
right?
Was a
as
biologist,
a social, as
yeah.
opposed to a social scientist. And I don't know whether that gave him sort of more cachet or not.
It certainly helped him get funding. He got funding from there was a national committee that had a lot of Rockefeller money. Most of his money came from Rockefeller Foundation. And it helped him get funding because he was seen as more respectable. And he was not interested in kind of why people did what they did and what their emotional feelings were or how they identified themselves. He said he saw himself as a collector of what people do. He was only interested in what he saw as the facts about what people do and not the emotions.
Well, it sounds like a biologist's approach to people's sexual behavior.
That's right.
What were, though, his biases as you look at his research and perhaps even the language of his research? Where did he sort of show up in his own work?
Well, he has two kinds of biases. One is he'd actually been an entomologist and he'd collected insects before. He collected a kind of gall wasp, and he still at the Kinsey Institute, there's this huge collection of hundreds of thousands of gall wasps that Kinsey collected from country after country. And as a collector of insects, he'd been interested in getting samples of every kind of variety. So he was much more interested in checking the varieties of sexual experience than he was in understanding how frequently these occurred in the population. And because of that, he spent a lot of time collecting data on people whose sexual behavior was not the typical, average sexual behavior.
Such as?
Well, he has higher rates of men who have sex with other men, for example. He probably has higher rates of he interviewed a lot of prostitutes, probably more than, because by the time that he was interviewing, actually, prostitution was really declining in number. Prostitutes were declining in number in the United States. He was interested in people who had contact with animals. He wanted to taste the variety of sexual experiences. So that was one bias. The other bias that I think is kind of a result of both of his being a scientist and of his own desire to liberate sexuality, which he didn't recognize at all.
But you can kind of read that into his research.
I don't think there's any doubt. And I interviewed both his co-researchers, and they really did understand quite explicitly that Kinsey had felt that sex needed to be liberated. And then every now and then in the book he gives little diatribes anyway that make it very clear that, you know, it's not that coded. But he felt that he actually believed that we probably all, that any kind of sexual outlet was just equally valuable to any other kind of sexual outlet, and that he didn't believe some people were this way and some people that way. He really believed we probably would all do everything if we were given the opportunity, and that we were in this sex repressive society, and that people suffered incredibly terribly for the fact that they had so many sexual desires repressed, and that this caused all kinds of problems, particularly problems for marriage. I will say that he was very pro marriage and the family, despite this liberationist
viewpoint. Well, it's an interesting tension, isn't there?
Yes. Well, not really. I think he just thought that he saw marriage as something that was necessary for the raising of children and the good of society, but he probably, I think it's pretty clear that he thought that if society wasn't so sexually repressed, that people wouldn't necessarily tie sexual fidelity in as part of marriage.
Well, he's still quoted today, and I wonder how you think his research stands up. Of course, that's 50 years ago, more than 50 years ago. People are different. There's been a lot of research since that time.
I don't think that you can place any reliability on his results because his sample was very poor for the reasons that I've already explained. And he wouldn't do probability sampling. And in fact, when the most prominent statisticians of the day wanted to do probability sampling, he wouldn't do it. So in that sense, I don't think his data reliable. But he did have some very interesting ways of interviewing that I think are still quite provocative and quite informative.
In what way? I mean, how would he get people? I'd assume you're talking about getting people to talk about themselves and talk about their behavior.
Well, he asked questions in a way that researchers don't normally ask. He was very concerned to give people permission to talk about things that they might not confess to. And so, for example, instead of saying, "Have you ever masturbated?" he said, "When did you first start masturbating?" And he left it up to the respondent to deny that they'd masturbated. And if the respondent said, "I never masturbated," later on he might say, "Well, when did you first start?" "Well, I know that, but when did you first start?"
I wonder, too, with Masters and Johnson, I mean, I think that's another name that the people associate with sex surveys, what did they bring to the discussion? And it seemed the way you wrote that they were more sort of female-centric, that they were more inclusive of female sexuality.
Yeah, technically, they didn't quite do a survey because what they actually did was watch people have sex, which is a little bit different. But what they did and what they had tremendous impact on surveys because what they did was discover the clitoral orgasm. Now, Kinsey had actually reported that women's orgasms are in their clitoris, but it was ignored and it wasn't picked up by the press and it just disappeared. You know, it wasn't one of those factoids, as you call it. But when Masters and Johnson wrote, the women's movement was getting going. That was picked up by the women's movement as a sort of militant female statement. And Kinsey, and so from then on, you get a lot of interest in things like multiple orgasm. Are women capable of having multiple orgasms?
G-spots.
You get into, and you also get interest in female masturbation, which hasn't really been quite such an interesting topic, at least since Catherine Davis in 1918.
but masturbation does appear through 100 years of surveys. I mean, a lot of concern about the effects of masturbation. I mean, that was clear reading through your book. Well, I wonder, as we look at the Playboy magazines, the Cosmopolitan, which probably is the female version of Playboy, what they brought to the whole sort of discussion about sex, and even the kinds of surveys that they might have run, you know, there's that sort of play, and even how the sort of Playboy philosophy was supposedly about, you know, female sex, and I would assume that the Cosmo philosophy was something about the, you know, what male sexuality was about. What do you see?
Well, I think those commercial surveys did three things. First of all, they set in the public mind that that's what a survey was, but they also really do give the public a place to go to find if what they're doing is normal. And they actually turn out to be quite reader-specific. And so, for example, if you take Cosmo and Ladies' Home Journal, they both did sex surveys. And they're geared to a very different audience. And so Ladies' Home Journal will say things like, X percent of the women in our survey had had affairs outside of marriage. But that was much lower than Red Book found. Because they're doing their readers,
course,
you know. So they're positioning Ladies' Home Journal. Cosmo, on the other hand, which is actually one of my favorite questions, in their question about how often you had sex, they code the answers. And you see, I think by giving the readers boxes to fill in, where those boxes are located is extremely important in telling you what normal is. And so Cosmo has several times a day as its first possible response, once a day as its second possible response, several times a week, and then once a week or less. So I assume if you're not sexually active at the moment, you have to check once a week or less because that's the only place to go. But it tells you that, you know, that the middle boxes are what people think they ought to check. Now, Ladies' Home Journal, on the other hand, you know, starts with several times a week and then several times a month, and it has a different set of boxes. And so it's all they're also telling their readers in a way what's appropriate, you know, what people do just by the kinds of boxes they set up to check as answers. So I actually think the way in which they are telling readers what's normal for us is very interesting. And then, you know, a magazine like Cosmo lauds the fact that the Cosmo girl is more sexually active than any other, you know, the readers of any other magazines.
Sociologist Julia Erickson is the co-author of Kiss and Tell. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Yes, let's fall in love. Why shouldn't we fall in love? Our hearts are made of it. Let's take a chance. Why be afraid of it? Baba today, let's close our eyes and make our own paradise. Little we know of it, still we can try to make a go of it. Oh, baby, we might have been meant for each other, to be or not to be, let our hearts discover. Let's fall in love. Why shouldn't we fall in love? Now is the time for it. While we are young, let's fall in love.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Bantam Books, publishers of Darkness Peering by Alice Blanchard, a psychological thriller debut. Available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, A.M. Holmes discusses her new novel, Music for Torching, and Ed Ward reviews a collection of rare pop treasures.
And I can tell he's a mic.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss, Cohen, in for Terry Gross. A.M. Holmes is a fearless and funny writer with a controversial career. Her first play, written when she was 19, portrayed Holden Caulfield from Catcher in the Rye as a real character that J.D. Salinger meets on a train. Salinger threatened a lawsuit, and the story made headlines. Her novel, The End of Alice, gave a somewhat romantic portrayal of a pedophile and was banned by some London bookstores. Her new novel, Music for Torching, is about a married couple, Elaine and Paul, who live with their two sons in an upscale, well-groomed suburb. But several sentences into the novel, and it's clear that there's serious trouble in this family. And by page 20, Elaine and Paul have purposely set their house on fire by kicking over the barbecue grill. A.M. Holmes is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and has written for The New Yorker, Mirabella, Bomb, Blindspot, and Story. She teaches in the writing program at Columbia University and the New School. I asked A.M. Holmes to read from the beginning of her novel, where Elaine and Paul are cleaning up after a party. Elaine is washing the dishes while Paul is straightening up the dining room.
Paul goes into the dining room, this time returning with the wine glasses, the bottle tucked under his arm. Elaine scrapes plates into the trash can. Paul puts the glasses down, brings the bottle to his lips, and finishes it, swishing the last sip round and round before bending over her shoulder and spinning it into the sink, splashing her. "Watch it," she says. "Gristle," he says. "You're doing it on purpose, poisoning me. I could taste the fat going right to the artery." "I should be eating legumes," he says. "I can't make legumes for eight," she says. Elaine loads the dishwasher. "What about her?" she asks. "Who?" "The girlfriend, the date, the woman Henry, who recently left Lucy, whom they all liked a lot, carried around all night like a trophy." "Nice," Paul says, not telling his wife that when he asked the date what she did, as in what her occupation was, she said, "What would you like me to do?" And when he asked, "Where do you live?" she said, "Where would you like me to live?" Paul doesn't tell his wife that before she left, she said, "Give me your phone number," and he willingly jotted it down for her. Paul doesn't tell Elaine that the date promised to call him tomorrow. He goes back into the living room for the dessert plates. "How old do you think she is?" Elaine calls out. Paul returns, his hands filled with wadded-up napkins. He shakes crumbs into the sink. "How old would you like her to be?" 60, Elaine says. She finishes loading the dishwasher, mumbling, "Hope it's fixed, hope it doesn't flood, hope the gasket isn't gone, hope you are right." "Hope so," he says. She adds detergent. "Sink's stopping up," she says. "The house is falling apart. Everything is made of junk." "It only lasts so long," he says, thinking about the date. "How many children do you have?" she had asked him. 2, he'd said. "Isn't that below average? Aren't you supposed to have 2.3, she'd asked. "We need so many things," Elaine says.
And that's A.M. Holmes reading from the very beginning of her brand new book, and it's called Music for Torching. You seem to be saying, I mean, one could argue that you're saying is that marriage is hell. Married people are bored with each other. They're unhappy with each other. One of them, these two characters, are arguing constantly, accusing each other constantly, accusing the other one of ruining their life, and on, a kind of depressing view of marriage, if that's the kind of snapshot you want us to walk away with.
I don't think that's really my snapshot. I think marriage is an incredibly complicated ecosystem. And I think people get married and they bring to it, and Paul and Elaine talk about this, they bring to it enormous hopes of, "I thought you were this kind of person, I thought we would have this kind of life, that together we would do the following things." And I think they've been married for quite a while now. I mean, it's not specified, but right. It's probably at least 15 years. And I think that they're feeling their own failings. They're feeling things that they haven't done for themselves. Elaine hasn't found a place for herself in the world. And I think she's an interesting character in that she's really stuck. And she's like a lot of women who sort of missed feminism, missed post-feminism, still don't really have a job or a career, and don't even know how to begin to reach out. The funny thing about that is when I was writing the book, I actually was at an art colony, and Betty Friedan happened to be there. And I said, "Betty, I'm working on this character who's stuck," thinking, you know, Betty would really, like, get in there and help me. And, you know, help me, not really help me, but talk to me about her and about her stuckness and be interested. Betty couldn't have been less interested in this woman being stuck. She's like, you know, "Tell her to get a job." And I thought, well, that's the problem. Elaine doesn't know she doesn't know how to do anything. She's so trapped, she needs, like, remedial training for how to figure out even what she would want to do. But Betty didn't care about that.
I'd love to have you actually read another section from the book, and I gave away a little bit in my intro in saying that by page 20, and there's much more that follows here, Elaine and Paul, whom we've just met, set their house on fire, and I'd love to have you read that section for us.
Sure. It's important to say, I think, that they choose to set their house on fire. It's not like an accident. They're outside working with the grill. Elaine pulls back her leg and kicks the grill. The coals fly up and out. The grill tips over. Everything sputters and smokes for a minute, and then slowly the fire builds up from the ground and moves towards the house. They stand watching as fire creeps up the back wall of the house. Wordless, each wonders if it is a game, a dare to see who will run for the garden hose. As the fire builds, their nervousness and excitement grow. Elaine begins to laugh and then stops herself. In the early evening light, the blue flame is nearly invisible. Fire seeps into a crack in the wall. A line of white smoke rises. Elaine watches, wishing she could hurry it, wishing she could be sure. Paul leans on Elaine and puts his shoes back on. "Get the kids and get in the car," he says. Elaine walks away, turning back to see Paul blowing on the fire, fanning it with his hands, encouraging the flame. "We're going out for dinner," Elaine tells Sammy and Daniel. "Roger," they say into their walkie-talkies. They get into the car and wait for Paul. A few minutes later, red-faced, breathless, he joins them. They drive to a nearby restaurant. The waitress fills their water glasses. Paul and Elaine smile at each other. "I'll have the steak," Paul tells the waitress, "and the baked potato with sour cream." "The fat," Elaine starts to say. "I just want to live," Paul says, "live and not worry. Is that possible?" "I'll have the same," Elaine says, closing her menu. During dinner, they hear sirens. They linger over coffee. The children eat ice cream sundaes. When the check is paid, they get back into the car and head home. The street is blocked off, fire engines and police cars. In the distance, they can see their house engulfed, flames shooting out of the roof. In the back seat, the children are oddly silent. "Is that our house?" Daniel asks.
Once again, that's A.M. Holmes reading from her new novel called Music for Torching. This chapter begins with Paul looking in the mirror and cutting most of, all of his hair off. And you're right, ruining something, actively destroying it, that he hasn't felt this powerful in years. And this idea of purposely setting your house on fire. And one gets the feeling, at least from this part of the book, that for them it's the chance at a new beginning, a new start at something.
Yeah, oddly. Yeah, I mean, I think that's really what's happening here, is that oddly, in burning down their house, Paul and Elaine are starting over again. I mean, they're really looking for a way out that's a way back into their lives, but they are so incredibly frustrated and out of their minds, I think, that this is how they do it. They can't find another way. They're really stuck.
But they still can't get out. I mean, even if they resort to something as dramatic as this.
They can't get out. I think the other thing that's important, and this is a very pro-marriage thing, is that they are inexorably bound. You can't imagine them separated, which I think is one of the fascinating things about some marriages. I actually love marriage. I think there's a therapist who, I can't remember who it is, who talks about marriage as the natural therapy. And the idea is that you basically bring to a marriage all of the junk from yourself and your life, and you work it out with this other person because you're there together as adults, not even as an adult and a child, and you play it all out.
I'm thinking, too, about the way this house plays such an important role in the novel. And I think most people have perhaps an overly involved or overly attached to the places that they live in for all the obvious reasons. I mean, this is the sort of mausoleum you set up to yourself.
Right.
And it makes me wonder whether you have an attachment to place. You talked about growing up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., but do you have a sort of nostalgia for houses you grew up in?
My parents still live actually in the same house that we don't move. We don't change, my family. I'm driving an 82 Honda still, just because.
So you do have an attachment.
I have an attachment. I think I'm one of these people who's oddly incredibly sensitive to place. If I'm in a ugly place or in a bad hotel room, I actually have to leave and go elsewhere.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I live in New York in the same place I've lived in since 1985 because it doesn't really occur to me that change is possible, so maybe that's part of it. But my attachments to place are in part aesthetic in that I have to be someplace where there's light and air and things feel comfortable. And I like to go, you know, to the beach. I like places from my childhood, but I'm not overtly attached.
But have you ever had the sort of impulse of trying to just, I mean, in order to disengage yourself from your life, of just burning it all down or destroying it all?
You know, I haven't. I think I'm one of these people who really feels if I did that, I actually wouldn't know who I was.
Ah, interesting.
So I think that very much actually, in a odd way, my places and objects define me.
I'll talk more with novelist A.M. Holmes after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer A.M. Holmes. Her new novel is Music for Torching. She's written a number of stories with male protagonists. I asked her if she identifies more with male characters than female.
Yeah, I mean, I think my first novel was told from the point of view of a 14-year-old boy. I love boys. I love men. I think they're really, really interesting. And I think the characters that I write from a female point of view, not that they don't interest me as much, but I am female, mm-hmm. and I kind of get that. And I sort of am inside that all day. And I really enjoy being inside another head. And somehow, I mean, I've always liked male characters a lot. And I find them easy to relate to, for lack of a better word. So I spend a lot of time with them, which is sort of unusual, I think.
As a fiction writer, you write what you don't know.
Yeah.
And you don't, since you don't inhabit a man's body, you don't know.
I don't know, but I ask them a lot of questions.
Yeah.
And I think the characters that I've written that are female that are close to my age, I have to say, have interested me the least. And I think it's in part because, on the one hand, you know it and you have some perspective on it. On the other hand, to render it in a way that's interesting, that's sophisticated, that gets inside of it and sort of turns it inside out is not so easy to do. And it doesn't interest me because I am so close to all of that. So I really like things that are different. I mean, for me, the most intense book so far was The End of Alice. And it was really from the point of view of a crazy person who is male, who's very, very different from me. But both artistically and intellectually, it was the biggest challenge. And I think Elaine and Paul, being inside a marriage that's 15 years old, I've not been married for 15 years. That interested me a lot, and sort of exploring that. I think the other thing about marriage that I'm into these days is people talk a lot about it as, for a while, everyone was getting divorced, and now the big move is to stay together. So I'm sort of watching all that very carefully and seeing how people do it.
This book that you've written, and I don't want to give too much away in our discussion, but certainly does have its denouement in a school where there's violence. I mean, very much what happened in Littleton. And there's so much talk these days about our violent culture and what causes children to do this and what are some of the images that they carry around that would inspire them to turn on their own friends. And I wonder, as a writer, of someone who, you know, plays with some violent imagery and certainly describing a family here where there's a lot of dysfunction, whether writers have that same responsibility as TV producers and movie makers to be responsible for the kind of languages and images that they create.
I think it's actually a really, really interesting question, and I would say I have a couple different answers. One is that in talking about Music for Torching, a lot of references on a literary level to work of John Cheever and different people have come up, and especially Cheever's work from the 1960s and stuff, which of course I'm very well aware of and influenced by. I also went back and looked at the music of that period. So you look at music of like Buddy Holly, the Everly Brothers, and look at the progression of music from then, when rock and roll was just happening and was thought to be dangerous then, to rock and roll now, you know, Nine Inch Nails and really very intense, violent, extreme music. And I think that we see the progression in film and in music much more so than literature. I think literature is a very antiquarian medium, and it hasn't taken on that stuff in that extreme kind of way in terms of representations. I also think it's important, which is sort of my second answer to the question, it came up a lot during conversations about The End of Alice, because that book is quite extreme.
About a pedophile.
Yeah, about a pedophile. And I think one of the things that was important was to say, if as a society we want the abuse of children to stop, if we want violence to stop, we need to figure out how to talk about it. And I think one of the functions that good literature can have is to provoke those conversations. So I think, well, I'm not doing things in a way to shock people just to titillate them and get them going. I'm doing things to make a point in the sense of making it inescapably clear. I felt if I wrote about a pedophile and then just said, and then something bad happened, people wouldn't know what actually happened. I actually, a long time ago, was standing in a coffee store and overheard people talking about Lolita and saying that the main character in Lolita didn't actually sleep with Lolita. And I kept thinking, how could you think that? He actually says that he did. But it was her sort of lack of wanting to know that that horrible thing had happened. And I thought, you have to make it undeniably clear. And in that way, people will be upset because it is a very upsetting thing.
But I wonder whether using the book Before This, The End of Alice,
sure.
whether, let's say, a pedophile was caught with, you know, mm-hmm. with book in hand saying, well, I identified so strongly with this character that A.M. Holmes had created that this was my inspiration. I'm,
right.
you know, overstating it.
And this is exactly the argument in England. Right. It turned into a front page news story for a week. It was sort of horrible. And I think my response to it is to say, first off, that the guy in The End of Alice is in jail. He's been in jail for 23 years. He's completely suffering. He is mentally ill in a very big way. It doesn't exactly make it sound like a good career choice. Mm-hmm. You know, be a pedophile. It's not like join the army. And that was important to sort of, you know, it's not like a positive representation, but also that people said to me, you know, what would happen if this book was found in somebody's apartment? And my answer is also, what if I made steak knives? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't mm-hmm. think that literature causes people to behave badly. I think people do sometimes behave badly. I think that in terms of kids, which was where we sort of started this part of the discussion, and violence and violent imagery, I think kids are susceptible to violence and violent imagery. Kids are not, for the most part, going into bookstores and buying works of literary fiction and then, you know, playing them out.
Do you wish, though, that literature, as you said, it doesn't sort of, I mean, in a perverse way, inspire people to do terrible things, but do you wish it were more inspirational, more powerful?
That's actually a good question. I mean, I think when you're saying it, literature doesn't inspire people to do terrible things, where my whole career as a writer started was with that play where J.D. Salinger tried to sue me. And
yeah.
what prompted the writing of that play was that the guy who shot John Lennon pulled Catcher in the Rye out of his pocket and stood there reading it, which freaked me out. I was 19 years old or whatever, and I was totally upset by that. And that was an example of literature, to my mind, being used to a bad end, representing something that I'm sure the author didn't intend it to represent, and then being carried forward in the culture as an emblem of something that completely beyond the author's control. I think books do become emblematic. Mm-hmm. Books do have meaning for people, and that's potentially a good thing. You know, certain characters like Holden Caulfield and different people throughout literary history have a lot of power.
That's why they get banned and people argue about them and debate
yeah,
them. And
exactly.
A.M. Holmes' new novel is Music for Torching. Coming up, some pop treasures from the late 50s and early 60s. This is Fresh Air. From the late 50s until the Beatles, New York's Brill Building on Broadway was where producers went to make the hit pop songs they needed. But the in-house music publishers also released plenty of material on their own labels, like Companion, Dimension, and Jubilee. Today, rock historian Ed Ward celebrates a recent collection of these rarities.
I hear the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
It's been romanticized in recent years. Working at the Brill Building was just that, a job. Yes, it was thrilling that the likes of Jerry Goffman, Carole King, Phil Spector, Jeff Barry, and Ellie Greenwich, and so on, were making pop history there. But like the workers in any factory, they had to produce and keep producing. In order to help them and to make some extra money, most of the publishing houses there had their own labels. They used them to release songs no one else had picked up or to release competing versions of songs they'd managed to sell. Often, these records were just higher gloss versions of the demos the writers recorded when they were trying to sell their songs. But, as On Broadway, a new anthology on Britain's West Side label, makes clear, sometimes they were pop treasures on their own. "You Bet I Would" was a little thing Carole King and Artie Kaplan tossed off one day for the Cookies, who demoed a lot of Brill Building songs. But somehow it got into the hands of Ronnie and the Relatives, a teen girl trio whom King didn't even like too much. It flopped, but the group, renamed the Ronettes for the record, caught the ear of Phil Spector, who was always hanging around, and he heard something King hadn't heard. The rest, of course, is history. Dickie went and did it. Went and Did It is one of my favorite songs on the collection, written by Jeff Barry and Ben Raleigh, and performed by the Delicates, who sound like another trio of demo dolls. Naturally, we never find out what this life-changing thing Dickie did actually was, which is the appeal of the record, and possibly what kept it off the radio. Little Eva, Eva Boyd, was a sometime cookie, and, famously, Carole King and Jerry Goffin's babysitter. She had one hit, The Locomotion, but she was also a major voice on Brill Building demos, and a fine interpreter of songs.
He gets up each morning and he goes downtown, where everyone's his boss and he's lost in an angry land. He's a little man, but then he comes uptown to my tenement. Uptown, I just don't have to pay much rent. And when he's
Phil Spector would build on this arrangement for the Crystals' more famous version of Uptown, and Eva's version was relegated to an album cut. Of course, some of the writers themselves longed to be performers, but only one had any success during this era. Carole King's It Might As Well Rain Until September, a classic separated by summer vacation song, made it onto the charts for 9 weeks in 1962. This demo rough version of a song later made famous by the Everly Brothers, though, never went anywhere for her.
I'll never let you see the way my broken heart is hurting me. I've got my pride and I know how to hide all my sorrow and pain. I'll do my crying in the rain.
She wasn't the only one who tried, of course. Jeff Barry also released a few records, including this one.
Most every day you'd find him on the beach at Malibu, sitting in the sun and sand with his sweetheart Sue. Yes, Sue was his first love, the one that he adored, and his second love was by his side,
his silver surfing board. Oh, they called him Johnny Surfboard. Surfing was his game. And to be the king.
A Teen Death surf song certainly bridged the gap between the past and the future in 1963, but that doesn't make it any less painful to listen to. Still, it does remind us that finding a way into the teen psyche was what life at the Brill Building was all about. These songs deal with every sort of crisis young love encounters, written and performed by people not much older than the audience they were trying to hit. And of course, when they weren't having crises, they were dancing. Surprising how much passion gets put into trivia like this until you remember it was their job. So here's to Dee Dee and the way she does the hula hop, whatever she was and whatever it was. There are 50 songs on this collection, running the gamut from intensely embarrassing to astonishing, reminders that sometimes you just can't stop and wait for inspiration to hit when the boss is looking over your shoulder.
Ed Ward writes about music from Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Kathy Wolf, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Bob Purdick was our engineer. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss, Cohen.
They say the neon lights up right on Broadway. They say there's always magic in the air. But when you're walking down that street and you ain't had enough to eat, the glitter of dried off and you're nowhere. They say the girls are something else on Broadway.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Little Brown & Company, publishers of The Queen Mother's Century by Robert Lacey, a book of photographs in bookstores everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the amazing efficiency of a migratory bird. We talk with birder and nature writer Scott Wiedensahl, author of Living on the Wind. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.